You're listening to the Inside the Mix podcast with your host, Mark Matthews.
Welcome to the Inside the Mix podcast. I'm your host, Mark Matthews, and I'm excited to have you here with me today. Whether you're a synth music producer, artist, or enthusiast, I promise you'll get something out of this show. Every fortnight, I serve up interviews with synth music artists and provide you with an insight into their careers, creative processes, influences, and music industry tips and stories. Let's dive in. So welcome to the Inside the Mix podcast. And in today's episode, I'm joined by Gaz and Tom of the award-winning Canadian electronic synth outfit Honeybeard. And in this episode, we'll be discussing life before Honeybeard, the birth of the outfit, and new album Oneiros. I hope I pronounced that right. And basic sort of the songwriting and creative processes. So Honeybeard, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, my pleasure. My pleasure. Signed to Retro Reverb Records, working with them. So I think you're the second outfit I've had on. I had Nick a few weeks ago from Ueno Nights. Really nice chap. So yeah, it's nice to have someone else on. Oh, and Cole as well. I totally forgot. I had Cole on a few weeks.
Oh, yeah, Cole.
Yeah,
how could you forget Cole?
You're able to get a word in.
You know what really what happened with that, which is really bad, is that there was a really bad connection, so we lost half the interview.
That's probably the best
thing. It's probably still too long.
We love Cole. We're always winding him up.
Yeah, he's great, isn't he? I love his audio messages that he sends. They're fantastic.
He's a good guy, but don't tell him.
Yeah, yeah, really nice guy. So I got your bio here. So you're an award-winning electronic synth duo from Toronto, Canada. The band has been creating music since 2012, drawing on influences such as Depeche Mode, Gary Numan, and The Doors. And you built quite a reputation for your frenetic live performances with edgy songs that have shaken up typical synthwave tropes whilst balancing dark synths over bright thumping beats. And I did notice on your Instagram that you've got your first gig booked in 2021 on the 15th. Exciting.
Yeah, should be a good night. Looking forward to getting back to pre-pandemic ways here.
Yeah, I can imagine. When was the last time you gigged?
We probably had the last possible gig before the pandemic. I think it was March 14th or something like that, 13th, 14th of 2020. So pretty much right before they shut everything down here in Ontario.
Oh, wow. That's 2020. That's mad, isn't it? So what we'll do is we'll dive straight into sort of life before Honeybeard. So what I really want to sort of get to know is your sort of musical life or your musical background. So if we start with yourself, Tom, what was your musical background? How did you start with your journey into music?
I was kind of always just, I kind of taught myself guitar, piano when I was younger, never really got into any formal bands or anything, just more had fun with friends here and there. And then, kind of would write silly little songs for myself and for nobody else in particular. And, kind of got started that way. And then I met, Gary here and, jumped straight into Honeybeard.
Amazing. So when did you meet Gary then? So, I mean, it says here 2012. Did you meet him before then, or was that you sort of met him in 2012?
We met, I think it was 2011 or early 2012. I can't quite remember. Gary's shaking his head yes to the early 2012 part. Yeah. We were playing, we had an indoor training for Aussie Rules football, and we met there. He was new to the game, so I taught him how to hold the ball and whatnot.
Aussie Rules, is that quite big in Canada then, Aussie Rules football? I say big, but well known.
It's the largest league outside of Australia, I believe, is the Ontario Football League. But I don't think there's very many other leagues outside of Australia, so it's really just wins by default. it's not a massive sport here.
Yeah, brilliant. So you met guys in 2012. So guys, what was your sort of background leading up until meeting Tom and starting Honeybeard?
I started in bands around 1994, and then I think my first proper band was in 1996. I think I was 17 at the time. It was called Freak with a PH, and we were absolutely brutal. And I only went on. I originally wanted to play drums, but then someone said, look, we need a bassist. So I said, oh, whatever. So I got a bass. And I was into Metallica at the time and all those other heavy bands, Megadeth and whatnot. And so I was into that kind of stuff. And it went from like Freak, which was a cover, a really poor cover band, which taught me what not to do on the stage, to I was a band called Devoid, which is like a grungy heavy metal stuff. And from there, I just went into various bands right up until 2004. I was in a band called Artificial Flight. And that was a bit more serious. We did a lot more work in Ireland, playing around the country. Well, not, we didn't get too big because, of course, not everyone shared my dream of having that as a full-time job. So when the economic crash happened in 2011, myself, my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, we decided, let's get the hell out of here. So we went to Canada. Well, we had two options, we had Australia or Canada. Came to Canada in 2011, November 7th. And I happened to hear about a thing called Australian Rules Football, which I've seen. It's basically a game that rips off an Irish sport called Gaelic, just heads up on that. And so I came down here because I needed to make friends, and I wanted to get band members. I wanted to get back into music, and I was going on, like, trying to source people out on the internet, and it wasn't great. Toronto is, like, not the friendliest of cities. You kind of have to meet people in sort of more close range ways. So I went down, and it was 2012, February 14th. It was a Tuesday night. And I went down that night, and I saw this big, buff, chunky, rugby player-looking guy. And I just happened to talk to him, and he was showing me how to kick the ball. And then we got a conversation about music, and he told me that he played guitar and piano, and that's all I needed to hear. So the next day, I asked him if he would like to start a band with me.
Oh, amazing. So going back to sort of your background there, so you mentioned you sort of your journey started in like 1994, and I noticed you say you played in various bands, and I noticed here you've got a Metallica Master of Puppets t-shirt on there. Amazing, by the way, one of my favourite albums of all time. So do you say it was quite a heavy band that you're in. So do you come from sort of like a rock or metal aesthetic or sort of sound? Is that one of your big influences?
Yeah, like a rock and grunge. When Nirvana came along, that blew me away. It's always one band that makes me sort of jump from like heavy metal then to grunge. Then around that time, I discovered The Doors, and that was it. The Doors is my favorite band of all time. And that sort of...
Yeah.
I'd be very tribal, go, no, I only like Nirvana. Like, fuck Pearl Jam, I hate them. Or, you know, I love Metallica, and I have no time for Megadeth. So that was just an immature way of looking at things, and I went from heavy metal to grunge to kind of alternative metal, sort of some Nine Inch Nails stuff, definitely a massive Tool fan. That definitely changed a lot of things. Mm. Then The Doors kind of broke me open into like older music and what that could be. And then eventually got into Pink Floyd. Pink Floyd showed me sort of the really genuine creative concept side of music and what real good guitar playing sounds like. It was a strange journey. Now, I grew up in early 80s, so I know my mom was always into like Boy George and Madonna and Gary Numan, all that kind of stuff. So, and my dad is into Jean-Michel Jarre. That's all he used to play. So the electronic element was always in the background. I used to think it was a guilty pleasure. I didn't think of actually writing music in the same vein.
Yeah, I would agree with that sort of sentiment. I very much think the same way. I was in a metal band for many, many years, and electronic music and sort of synth pop of the 80s was always, like you say, sort of a guilty pleasure for me. I'd like put on Duran Duran every now and again and stuff like that. And it was always, yeah, that guilty pleasure. But then at some point it turned and I was actually, you know what, I'm going to have a go at producing this myself. So that's quite a cool journey that you've mapped out there. So Tom, what sort of journey have you taken with regards to sort of influences that leads you up into where you are now?
Well, when I was younger, Canada is quite a big country. So it was a lot of, spent a lot of time in the car with kind of my dad in charge of the radio. So it was a lot of, his favorite band would be the Beatles. So I'd, you know, you end up 5 hours in a car ride listening to the Beatles kind of nonstop, kind of got, you know, influenced by them quite a bit. Like a lot of the 70s rock was played a lot in our house. And then once I kind of, I think when I was in grade four, the first CD or tape that I bought was the Green Day Dookie album. So like 1994-ish. And kind of went into high school and a little bit of a, you know, got more and more into like harder punk rock kind of stuff. And eventually aged out of it back into, you know, now I'm very, very eclectic in my music taste. So it's kind of all over the map now.
Yeah. Dookie. Is that the album with Basket Case on it? Have I got that right?
Yeah.
The album with Basket Case. Yeah. Did you listen to much Offspring around that time?
A little bit. For whatever reason, I didn't get as into Offspring. I know like lots of my friends are, that was like their,
Gaz has put his thumb
their
down
there. Pivotal album for them.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I was the other way around. So I listened to I didn't really pay much attention to Green Day. It was the Offspring. So yeah, I can kind of, I can kind of see that.
The Offspring, all they did was cool. Shout his vocals. So I just always got a pain in my head listening to the Offspring.
We'll be right back.
So I've got a hunch about a common struggle we all face: mastering. If you're an independent artist or music producer, you've probably encountered the frustration of masters that just don't hit the mark, right? They lack balance and refuse to play nicely across different devices and environments. Ever found yourself wondering, why don't my masters sound like my references? Perhaps you've spent countless hours attempting to master your tracks only to be unsatisfied with the results. Maybe you've tried every silver bullet plugin or even dabbled in AI. Or perhaps you're already working with an engineer, but you're eager to explore different possibilities. Well, here's the solution you've been searching for: Synth Music Mastering. I'm offering a game-changing opportunity with a one-time free test master for a limited time. Picture elevating your music with my unwavering commitment to quality and a personalized touch that you just don't get with the big mastering studios. The best part, it won't cost you a penny. Just submit your finished mix and let's see how we can transform your music together. Don't let mastering be a mystery any longer. Say goodbye to the frustration and step into a world of sonic excellence. Grab your free test master now. Click the link in the episode description or head over to synthmusicmastering.com.
Yeah,
Dexter, it is one of those, isn't it? I remember seeing them live. They're really, really good live, but it is fundamentally him shouting a lot of the time.
But Tom, you were a big Pennywise fan, weren't you?
Pennywise. I saw them live at Warped Tour, probably 97 or something.
I always remember Pennywise. I don't know if you ever played Tony Hawk's 2 on PlayStation, but they did a song for Tony Hawk's 2, and I cannot remember what it is, but it's an amazing song.
I wouldn't be able to recall it off the top of my head.
No, that's going back 20 years or so now for me. I'm going to look into that. I'm going to find it on Spotify, actually. I haven't listened to that in ages. But I've gone off on a tangent there. But yeah. So we're moving on to sort of Honeybeard. So you mentioned you started in 2012. So my first question with regards to that is, where did the name come from? It's quite an interesting name.
You want to take it, Gaz? It's kind of your thing.
It's a stupid name for a synth band. It really is. It's a stupid name for a band that's trying to not...
The amount of times we get booked on shows and it's like we're playing with guys who have like cellos and violins and banjos in their band and it's like a folk night and we're like, yeah, we're just going to set up our lasers over here and these synthesizers. It's a really strange name for a synth band.
Yeah, a bit of a curse. Everyone thinks we're really going to be like having, you know, a strand of straw coming out of our mouth wearing checkered shirts and straw hats. It's strange, but I wouldn't blame them. But really where it came from was just when the economic crash in 2007, 2008, and 2009 really, really, really destroyed Ireland, because it's an open economy. We just can't latch on to natural industry. So I had a really good job and then I lost it. And then I was in this big rented, massive, big rented house with cars and stuff going, what the fuck am I going to do? So I was in a band at the time, as I spoke here, Artificial Flight. It was like a alternative rock band, and I sang a lot of falsetto, but I would sing aggressively as well. So it was murder on my throat. So it became quite intensive at one point. We would practice 3 nights a week, and it would just be too much. So because I was out of work, I was also out of time. Like, I go to bed at like 4 in the morning, and so I would also get drunk a lot, because what the fuck else are you going to do when you're unemployed? And I had like a severance check, so I was definitely drinking all that. And there was one day where it got so bad, I would have honey, and I'd squeeze it in my throat to kind of coat my throat, so because it was sore, and it really helps me. And I woke up one morning, I had a big beard as well, just because, you know, I was just so unkept. I was like, I was wearing a string vest. It was just see a picture of a guy down on his luck, a stupid ginger Irishman down on his luck, drunk with a sore throat, yeah. Drinking honey and drinking
in a string vest.
And I woke up one morning and the honey got stuck all over my beard. I obviously missed my face, and I had to cut it. And then it was just that moment I was like, oh my God, what have I become? So it was funny. I wrote a song, an acoustic song called Honeybeard, and that didn't go anywhere at the time. But as me and Tom in early 2012 were sort of brainstorming names, we were coming up with the fucking shittest names. And then yeah. We came up with a shittier name, but for some reason, other people liked that one. So we spread it, a couple of friends, they were like, oh, I love it. And I don't think they realized we were into lasers and MIDIs and electronic stuff, you know? Yeah. So I think at that time, we generally were playing acoustic songs, so it fit. And then that's how it came about.
When we kind of started, we started piano and acoustic guitar. So definitely was a more fitting name for that type of
yeah.
sound.
But then,
yeah.
Around 2010, I went to the movies and I saw Drive. This is the typical blueprint for a lot of people. And we didn't realize this until 2018, Tom, when we found out there was a synthwave scene. We thought we were the only ones that knew about this bloody thing. And I got that soundtrack, and it was also a soundtrack because I moved over to Canada at the same time. And I didn't like that. I liked the stuff that had vocals in it. I cut out everything else and I put it on the playlist in. It was great. And then eventually it was like, Tom, you know what? I think we could figure out, because I had a distinct disdain for drummers, because the last band I was in, the drummer using two of my band, he was a terrible person. I was like, I just don't want to deal with drummers right now. So let's see if we can get if we can put the drums on computer or a drum machine or something. And that coupled with just being so buzzed about the Drive soundtrack and then finding out that this kind of synth pop is alive and kicking well and sounds great, that accumulated into what Honeybeard eventually became.
That's an amazing story. I think starting out what you said about there being unemployed and having the honey in your beard and whatnot, which is an amazing story. But then leading into how you then found Drive and then you found like the whole synthwave scene in like 2018. And it's interesting you mentioned Drive because, like you say, it is a blueprint for a lot of acts. So this is the 20th or 21st episode of the podcast. And I would say 75% of the people I've interviewed, if not more, have stated Drive as a massive influence.
The only thing though, I would say, just in art, is that we thought we were the only ones that really loved this movie. Like, we didn't know about other people. The Valerie Collective was going on around this time, and other people were starting to connect. I mean, I think Valingo, that podcast, he was coming up at that time, and other people were like reading his stuff and discovering each other and all that stuff. You know, and we just were completely oblivious to that. We thought we were, like, our first song that we did and wrote, we called Drive. We didn't think anyone would, you know, go, like, if anyone saw that now, they'd be like, oh, my God. I'm sure a lot of people in the synthwave scene would be bitching about how unoriginal we are. But back then, we thought we were onto something unique. You know, we thought we were, wow, this is great. And we were discovering bands like the Chromatics, and then we'd find out who sounded like the Chromatics. And it was a complete discovery for us. And the more and more we're like, you know, like we love Depeche Mode and Gary Newman and, as you said, Duran Duran and all those bands when we were young just started to make sense. And we taught ourselves how to work logic. That's our deal. And it kind of took off from there. And the power it gave us, didn't it, Tom? It was just like all of a sudden we could put a full orchestra into our sound. And it was just great. The freedom was great.
Well, what's nice is we're still, I'd say, pretty novice at using logic. We're by no means experts, so we're constantly kind of learning new tricks and new sounds and new ways to do things. So a lot of figuring that out comes from listening, like, oh, I like that type of sound or that effect. Like, let's try to figure out how that it kind of like how that's done or how we can accomplish something similar. Really, not knowing the software kind of helped us in our songwriting because it kind of forced us to, the songs had to sound good whether or not the production was good, right? So I think it kind of forced our songwriting into more melodic, kind of catchy songs just because we couldn't get away with the our bad production skills, I guess, especially in the early days.
Yeah, I suppose it's quite like the argument for I play guitar and I was self-taught for a number of years. And because I'm trying, no one's showed me how to use it. I'm trying to learn it myself and I'm trying to imitate other sounds I hear. I guess it's quite similar in sound design. You're like, you hear a sound, you try and create it. But at the same time, yeah, at the same time, you're then creating new sounds and new soundscapes to use in your, and so you're creating that originality. So it's interesting.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you mentioned about 2018 then, and then you found the synthwave scene. Do you think not realizing that there was a scene was a positive for you when it came to writing your music, because it's sort of like you weren't influenced by other artists that already existed, if that makes any sense? So you can sort of like create in that bubble thinking you're the only ones there.
I think it definitely was beneficial at first to be completely unaware, and like our influences were less from within the scene and more from, we pulled stuff from outside, you know, like from the Doors or the Beatles, or we pulling more from what we'd grown up with and adding that into kind of our synth productions, as opposed to like really trying to capture the synth sound or the synthwave sound. Is we weren't really aiming for that. We were aiming for, did the song sound good to us? Not did it fit within this genre or whatever.
Yeah,
and I think that's the best way to do it. I think
it was definitely advantageous because, first of all, we've played, I'd say, over 70 shows in Toronto. Yeah, around that. And it's a tough nut to crack. And there's not a big appetite for synth type music. There is, but it's very clicky, very hipstery, very fucking annoying, to be honest. And, you know, we try to like get chummy with them and play stuff, but we don't drink that Kool-Aid, right? So we didn't really blend in with that scene. So to know that there is such a scene that's welcoming and accessible, like the synthwave scene, was amazing for us, because they were like, oh, great, like-minded people who aren't going to judge us because, you know what I mean, we of clothes we wear when we go on stage, or the bravado that we, you know, it's like, it was great. It was just, we had somewhere where we could belong. And, but also from that, it's been interesting. The scene is very self-critical. It's all over the place at the moment, but it's when we're, you know, from our position, it's like, wait, you guys are gold. This is a gold little nugget. You know, I know everyone's concerned about it and all that, but it's look, when you're in the wilderness of the Toronto music scene and you're up against it all the time, and we'd be actively playing all the time, right? We're a live band first and foremost. And then to come into such a wonderful scene with great opportunities and great camaraderie and excellent sort of, everyone complains about the production factory of synthwave, but that's great because that means that people come in, they shoot their shot, because it's very easy these days. It might sound crap, so what? Let it fly. Don't pay attention to it.
Yep.
They'll keep coming back and getting better and better and better. And a lot of the bedroom folks that can't last the journey, they'll go eventually, and it'll just self-replicate and get better, 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 and bigger, bigger, bigger. Right now, we think it's big, but it's a global phenomenon. It's not big. It really isn't. It can't survive in any one city. So, it's so like at the very start of growth. And I think people are tearing their heads about that. So for us, the big advantage coming into the scene was that it is a special little nugget, and we are absolutely delighted to be where we are in it. And it's a great place.
Yeah, I really like that idea of what you said there about bedroom producers and being at the start of like what is a scene that is growing. And then as time progresses, those who stay the course are just going to get better and better and better and better. I really like the idea of that. And then the quality of music is going to improve. And it's like, I totally agree with the idea of what you said there as well about how just release music and it might be shit, it might not, but the only way you're going to progress is by keeping writing, release, and recording and releasing music. So my next question to you, I think you sort of answered it there, really, was about which, are you a live band or are you a sort of a studio band first? So you mentioned being a live band first and foremost. So what made you sort of take that decision to be just a live band first and foremost?
I think that was mostly because I had zero experience in bands, and Gaz came from like a rock live band background. So he kind of led the way on how it's supposed to be done. And the only way he knew to do it was to pound the pavement and play as many shitty shows as possible until we got better and better. And we played a lot of shitty shows.
We did, Tommy, didn't we? Holy shit.
And a lot of Gaz was also very unaware of, like I mentioned earlier, how big Canada is, and would book shows. You're like, oh, we're playing one night in Windsor and the next night in Montreal. How far is that drive? I'm like, oh, like 8 hour drive, and you know, no problem, we'll make it.
You see, in Ireland, you can get to each side of Ireland within 8 hours, no problem. And actually, you can get to the other side of, so I'm in the east, you get to the west in 4 hours, you get to the south in six, you know, get to the north in three. Like, yeah, Canada's.
And during rush hour, we can't even cross Toronto in that much time.
Canada's too big, man. You don't need all that space. But anyway, we are a live band, because I think one of the reasons why bedroom producers don't last the course, and that's a generalization, it really is, but you kind of see it sometimes. They're more susceptible to falling by the wayside. Is that the fortitude to go through the live show circuit? It breaks your heart. It really does. It can be immensely rewarding and immensely absolutely fucking depressing. We played some amazing shows where the crowd was just raucous, people jumping off our stage, everyone like asking to autograph our merch and all that. Like, we don't know who these people are. And then the next moment, we're in some backwater where there's this buzzing sound all the way through our set. The sound person doesn't give a shit. Other bands walk out and no one turns up. And you've traveled 4 or 5 hours and paid a lot of money. So you have those kind of days. But that makes you. And also, something that this new album that we did didn't get the benefit of is that we tend to would play a lot of our songs live. We think they're finished. We play them live. We're like, oh, you know what? That didn't work. Or this could work. And we playing them live makes them better. So that's always been good. But we are a live band, but I think ultimately we're songwriters. We're not producers, you know? We're not snobby musicians. Like, Tom can read music. I can't. I can hear music. That's it. But we're just songwriters first and foremost, as well as live performers.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with that. I think the idea of sort of like cutting your teeth on the live circuit does help sort of shape you as a musician. I mean, I've been there myself where you've traveled sort of 4 hours and you play to the other bands and their girlfriends and their friends who turn up with them. That's if they stay and they don't go to KFC whilst you're performing and then come back and do their gig. So yeah, I think it's definitely a way of cutting your teeth as a musician. Yeah.
It also kind of shows you what it's like to get criticized and what it's like to get rejected. Because if you don't go through that rejection, I mean, even in the life, I've played many bands and I've played friends who were in many bands. At one point, nearly every person in my school was in a band. I'm probably one of five out of like 50 that are still in bands. And some of those are like wedding bands now, right? So there's probably two guys, me included, that are in original bands still to this day from my class. And it just goes to show you that it's not for everyone. It is genuinely a hobby. And when it gets rough, they bail out. If you are a bedroom producer that's only existed on Twitter and Bandcamp, and you know, you're just like me and Tom, and we took out our first EP, it's not great, right? The production's not great. All the tricks and all the stuff, we were just completely raw. But we went out and we gigged it and we made improvements, and that's what it was. People saw it live and saw the energy live, but then when they listened to the CD, they were like, oh, that's not the same energy. It's because we didn't get there yet. So when bedroom producers put their stuff up, and you know, it doesn't have that polished feel, or it's a little bit too generic, and then people shit all over it, and rightly so. That's the way that the things go. They either take it on the chin, or they keep moving forward. Now, with a small scene like this, you can decide, what am I going to be? Am I going to be like a skullet? Am I just going to absolutely be just tear this youngster apart, or am I going to be a little bit more decide not to review it, or am I going to say, look, this wasn't the best. There's a lot of room for improvement. But you could tell that there's a lot of talent there waiting to come. We're looking forward to the next record. You know, there's ways to do that. Anyway, that's an aside. But that's how we come up with regards to that.
Yeah, I think it's a, like you say, it's a good pathway. I think learning, I think the audio, the music industry, like you need to learn how to handle rejection, because I mean, and criticism as well. And I think the live circuit certainly does set you up for that, because it can be quite a harsh environment, like you mentioned. Yeah, definitely agree with that. So I want to ask you a question now about your live setup. So how does that work then? Is it just the two of you, or do you get others involved, like session musicians or depth musicians in, or is it just the two of you performing?
Just the two of us.
And how does that look then? So
so usually what we do is we'd separate out our drum track. So the drum track is playing as like a backing track. And then for each song, depending on the complexity of our setup and how much gear we're able to bring, usually Gary and I are playing, usually it's two synth parts each or two other parts. And then Gary would sing live.
I was going to ask that later on. So Gary, yourself, you're the singer then on the tracks for Honeybeard. Is that correct? Oh, amazing.
And isn't it weird? Tommy, remember this. When we first started out, we didn't figure out all that at the time. We just put the drums in and the bass in. I mean, we'd even play, we had a drum pads. We'd be playing the drum pads. And I don't know how to play piano or anything. I just play by ear and I just taught myself. And I'd be playing here, like something on the Alesis here, just like playing something and singing away. And then Tom would have two, he'd be playing maybe the lead part and the bass. And then all it really in the end was just the drums. And our setup was fucking massive. And
it took like we need to hire a van just to transport our stuff for the two of us.
Oh yeah, we had so much gear, and we put electric guitars in there as well, and we had pedals. And there's a video of us in our YouTube. Our second ever show was actually captured on video, and you can see some of it. And we had the stacked
a three tier stack or something of keyboards.
Yeah, three tier stack. You can even see us. It says Mike and I had this little. I had a page and I had a checklist of everything to turn off and turn back on again, because we'd go to the next thing and I'd be playing the wrong sound and I need to start my computer again or some bullshit like that. It was funny looking back, but we were so novice. I was just used to plugging a guitar and playing, but that's just what you do. That's how we started up. And then over time, we're like, fuck that, right? We've proven that we can do this live, so we don't need to do that anymore. No one else is doing it. So we just took everything down. I play a guitar and I'll sing, and I might play some lead parts depending what I can do. All I try to do is sing well, because I'm not the greatest singer consistently, and play what I need to play, because I always like to play something. I can take the guitar off and I can jump out into the crowd because it's all wireless, and perform, like move around and dance and interact. And Tom, he's kind of the engine room. He'll make sure that everything's lined up, that he's playing the main parts, the bass, whatever. So we can fit everything into a hatchback where it used to be a van.
A van. I found that amazing that you filled a van and you didn't even have a drum kit. That's good going, like to fill a van.
Well, we also played a lot of shows where we had to provide our own PA systems.
Oh man, they're the worst when you got to provide the PA and set that up as well.
You know it's not going to be a good one. Then.
And
because Tom drives, I don't need a car in the city anymore. Because Tom drives, Tom would drive the show, which meant that I would be the donkey, right? So I would have to, Tom would just load up, it's like, you know that game Buckaroo? Tom would just load up all the stuff on top of me, right? I'm just like this pack mule, and then I'd go up like 20 million thousand flight of stairs. So, you know, it was also good to reduce our footprint. So we just carry everything under our arm in one go. Thanks, Tom. Back pains because of that.
And the lasers as well, then. Do you have those? Have you got a light laser show? Is that timed to your music? Or is it sporadic?
No, it's just sporadic. I think Toronto has banned fog machines or smoke machines or hazers inside venues now.
Oh, really?
So I don't know what kind of effect they're going to have.
Yeah, that's right. It wasn't a ban. Definitely. It was that a lot of the venues in here are like probably there were, you know, one day like a jewelry store or something. So the whole fire system isn't set up to cater for a live stage. You know what I mean? So you've got the fire suppression system right over the stage, which sucks. We only set off the fire alarm twice. Isn't that right, Tom?
Two times, yeah.
There was the last time we did it, we promised we wouldn't set it off. And our old smoke machine died. So Tom went in and to hire one out, and the only one they had was this fucking man. It looked like a bazooka. And it was like a jet engine, really. So Tom got it, yeah, whatever. We didn't even test it. So in the middle of our set, Tom hits the button. We didn't check the setting, because obviously this is for a massive stage. Like, this is for...
It's for like a stadium show.
So bad, we couldn't see our hands. And the fire system went off and people couldn't see anything. It was like being in the middle of a fire and we were choking and it was this disaster. And half the people left because the fire went off and everyone just evacuated. That was another disaster of a show we had.
That was the first song too, I think.
Third song.
That makes me sort of like want to get back gigging again. I haven't gigged for probably about 4 or 5 years, and it's stories like that that make me want to get back.
Are you
gigging.
Sure? That was a nightmare.
No. It's just talking about it. It just brings back memories of the gigs I've played where stuff like that has happened, where you're locked downstairs and you're performing in basically a basement and there's no ventilation like that. You've got the smoke machine going and you can't see and all that sort of stuff. And it's like 35 degrees inside.
But we did get lasers. Yeah. We bought a bunch of lasers, cheap lasers, and they look great. But unfortunately, Toronto was just, it's nicknamed No Fun Toronto because they don't take risks and stuff like that. So, but I think for this gig, hopefully this doesn't get used in a court of law, but I think me and Tom, I think we'll just do a couple of puffs just to get enough haze for lasers to go.
Yeah.
And hopefully doesn't set off anything.
Are they allowed to vape inside though? A vape's not going to set off a system, is it? Vape. I'm assuming people vape inside in Toronto, or is that like
No. This is Toronto. We can't have any fun.
It's the official tagline of the city.
Strict. It's stupid.
Yeah. So good. So we're gonna move on now to like the new album that's coming out. Aneros.
Aneros.
I think I pronounced it right.
Aneros.
Yeah.
Hey, don't ask us. We don't know how to pronounce it.
Can you sort of tell our audience a bit about the album? What to expect in terms of like influences, themes, or concepts on the album? The influence and the songwriting behind it.
So it's kind of as of right now, it's planned to be the last chapter of kind of an ongoing story arc that Gary has carefully crafted from our first EP to now. So there's kind of if you listen closely enough, which I'm sure nobody ever has, but there is some sort of through line if you go from our first EP and then it'll finish here at our newest full length here.
Oh, cool. So the first EP, did that come, was that 29 no it wasn't
2016?
I was on Spotify. Okay, 2016. So how many tracks are we expecting on the album?
We got nine.
Nine tracks. Nice.
Yeah.
So with regards to the songwriting process, how does that work between the two of you? Because obviously at the moment you're in separate towns, cities. So generally, do you both of you come up with ideas and share it with one another? Is there like a primary force when it comes to songwriting? Is there someone who takes the lead? How does that sort of dynamic work between the two of you?
So usually how it goes, obviously it's, every song's a bit different, but usually Gaz and I will kind of write songs separately, like almost, as close to complete as possible. Maybe not quite complete, but we write pretty complete ideas. And then we show them to each other and we'll actually record a lot of them. Like we'll get vocals on a lot of them and then kind of pick from there. So we kind of, I'll choose what I like from what Gaz has written and Gaz chooses what he likes from what I've written. And we kind of whittle it down from there. But this has been a lot, this album's been a lot more writing separately than previous releases where we were obviously together a lot more than we had been in the last year and a half here. So this one didn't get as much of like the, we usually have one or two songs that we kind of write together at just kind of jamming, coming up with something. So this album kind of didn't get that aspect of our, didn't get that kind of song, unfortunately.
Yeah. Do you think then that your new album's going to sound slightly different because of that? Or do you think it's sort of like remained similar in terms of your, in terms of the sort of like the sound of the album, of the music?
One thing I've always, I always find that our songs almost don't sound similar to each other on the albums. So like, I find like you can play two different songs on our album and they don't necessarily sound that similar. I don't know if you would agree with me there, Gaz, but I think there's like a, some sort of secret sauce that makes everything kind of sound like a Honeybeard song, even if the songs, and I don't know, I've never been able to put my finger quite on what that is, but, it seems to come, that's like kind of what, I'll write something and Gaz would often say like, it's not a Honeybeard song. And same, he'll do, he'll write something and he'd be like, yeah, it doesn't quite fit with what we do.
Tom, I think, yeah. So this is one of the reasons why we're, if you were to ask anyone else, this question, like Michael Oakley, for example, he mixed our album. So I was, you know, I was talking to him about his newly released one. People of his talent and degree, and then you talk to the bedroom producer as well. I think people with that who are producers first and foremost, they would answer that question better than we would. We are bluffers, right? We came from like a alt folk thing and stumbled into this because we didn't want a fucking drummer. And we like the album Drive. So there's no rhyme or reason to what we're at. We're not a, we're definitely are not a science. We don't know what we're at half the time. Like I got Serum, and with Serum, I got a bunch of free, like, what are they called? Templates. So in those templates, like, geez, they sound great. So we like stripped the template of all the melodies and stuff and used the sounds of those templates because we couldn't get anything better than that, you know? So we're just using the tools that are with us to write a song, and not sort of not produce it in a particular vein. You know what I mean? It's just whatever the fuck we come up with that we like and we both like, really. If we both like it, then it's a winner. If not, then it doesn't, either doesn't get passed or it gets redone again. So we are, I would say, technically inconsistent, but I don't think you'd notice. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does make sense. Yeah. So it's, you sort of like, you're songwriters first and foremost, and you're using the tools that you have in front of you to get your ideas down. Yeah, it does make sense. So you mentioned Michael Oakley there. So did he do is he doing the new album, or did he do the, is he doing the new album and he's, did he do the previous one as
no,
well?
No, he mixed this one.
So
one of the problems, but it's been weird. It's like we're not acting like an actual band of the past since lockdown because we can't see each other. We can't go in and jam in Toronto. We can't go out and watch bands and get pissed and talk about how shit they were, how great they were. Like that all adds into an album. So this feels like a laboratory fucking experiment of some sorts. With that, I mixed and mastered the last EP, the Whispers of Light one, which I was pretty happy with, but this was different. This is our second album, but the first one is on vinyl. So that had me a bit worried. I didn't want to bluff it and then mess it up. So I was out having a few beers with a couple of the folks in Toronto. Michael was there chatting to him. We just got talking, and like the man's a genius. Like he's a genuine genius. And it's not just to say it to him. Like I just watched him. And I was like, well, that's how geniuses must operate. Because I'm glad we did it because he took it and he made it sound professional, better than we've had a Juno Award winner, which is the Canadian Emmy Award winner, work on our last album. And that sounded great, but back then our own production of songwriting was great, but now we've leveled up. So we wanted to, again, level up again with the mixing. So we got him on board, because if you listen to this stuff, it's done so well, it's balanced. The stuff we wrote, especially because Tom's sending me over files, I'm sending over files, it wasn't done naturally. So levels were all over the fucking shop. Automation was all over the place. And it just became so tough. And I went through like a songwriting block at one point. And it was just tough to be... I didn't like the process of writing this album, I'll be very honest. It was difficult. But we got there in the end, and we put out a bunch of songs that we love. We got there, but it wasn't easy. And I think taking Michael on board just made sure that we were so exhausted from the songwriting process, let's give it to an absolute professional. So we don't mess that part of it up and don't cause more stress and delay it any longer. And he was gracious enough to say, yeah, let's do it. And yeah, it sounds great.
I think a lot of the people we used to mix our previous releases were also from like a rock background or a guitar band background. So they didn't grasp kind of what we were going for as easily, I think, as Michael kind of seemed to pick up exactly what sounds we wanted and how we wanted to sound. He kind of understood the language a little more.
Yeah, I think there's argument to say that having someone who's an expert in that particular genre, who's then going to take what you have and use his expertise in that genre and then sort of take it to that next level. And I suppose you mentioned there about creating it in isolation. So although you're in two separate towns and cities, but creating it in isolation, being able to send it to someone else and get their sort of opinion, their viewpoint and their production on it as well, must be a great thing.
It was also like a really long, like it felt like a really long writing cycle where by the time we were ready to mix it, I feel like we'd both listened to each song like 4 billion times. And, you know, you kind of your ear can't hear them properly because you've heard them so much. So it was good to get fresh ears on it for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I think that once again, I think there's an argument for that in the mastering stage, in that it's always good to get someone else to have a fresh set of ears, whether or not they master it or mix it or not, and just have someone else listen to it and get their opinion on it. Because like you can, I don't know what the right phrase is. It's not audio blind, but like you can hear things and then you tweak things and then you just make it worse as you keep going. I find that. I don't know if you guys do.
I always say Gary's biggest problem is he can't leave well enough alone. He'll be, if he was left to his own devices, he'd be still tweaking the songs probably. Mm,
yeah. Snares, I find. Percussion. Constantly.
That's the thing. We don't like life. Drums, as in we don't pay enough attention to them. So if you ever truly listen to Honeybeard songs, we hear the same drum thing going on and on and on. But, I think Michael helped us fix that.
Yeah. I'm with you on that one. I leave the drums. I say I leave them. I do try and tackle them first, but it's the bit that I find the least enjoyment out of when it comes to mixing or producing. Yeah. Or
and this is the difference.
Very tedious.
Producer,
yeah,
that's the difference between us, right? We will just get sick of it and say, "Fuck this! This is not what we do. We write and we play." So this whole production thing, even though it's been great for us and we get stuck into it, it really isn't our forte at the end of the day. So we will I'll keep fucking around with it and then I'll really get disheartened with it. In fact, I haven't listened to the album since it all got completed. Well, it's actually been in the can for a few months now. So I'm looking forward to it. When it comes out, I'm going to listen to it again, like with new ears. So
I just did that recently. It's I was very
good.
Pleased.
So
with
it wasn't terrible. That's great. Great news.
It's good to know after 2 months of it being in the can, yeah. As you say. So the release date for the album, have you got a release date for it?
Yes, December.
November.
Gary, you're going to have to help me.
November 16th.
November 16th.
And it'll be our first release on vinyl. It'll be done through the Retro Reverb Records via Bandcamp. So Cole has been instrumental in getting all that together. I'm surprised it didn't take longer because apparently some sort of vinyl shortage around the world, but he's managed all that and it should be ready to go by that time. We're excited because we always wanted to get vinyl, but it's so expensive. It's like pretty expensive over here in Canada as well. So I don't know what deal he got, but it kind of worked out for us. Yeah, so you'll see. Amazing. We're also in the. We're trying to get some videos done in the meantime. So hopefully, you might see a single at the start of November with a video. Hopefully,
fantastic. So you're releasing on vinyl. Are you going to be releasing on cassette? I know a lot of acts and artists are releasing on a cassette as well at the moment. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that'll depend how the vinyl sells. The vinyl goes, then it'll probably go to a different format. We'll see. We're just focusing on a vinyl release first. We're going to hold back our streaming just to make sure that sells out, because it's too expensive. You know, you can't take. You really have to try your best to sell that vinyl. We've got some coming over to us to Canada for when we play live shows so we can sell. And we'll sell them out in live shows, no problem. But we just want to make sure we sell everything that we get online.
So are you going to be releasing it on vinyl and online at the same time? Or are you doing a staggered release?
No, it'll just be a typical Bandcamp release that you see. It'll be available for vinyl and you'll be able to buy it digitally. That's how it'll work. So it'll be up to people if they want to buy it digitally and download it, or if they want to get it on physical platform. And then Spotify and all those other streaming, we're going to hold off maybe 2 weeks, 2-3 weeks maybe, and then we'll pull the trigger on that.
Fantastic. So for the audience listening, as soon as the album is available to stream, I will add links to the show notes for this episode so they can just go straight in and find that for the Bandcamp, etc. So they can go in and order that.
We don't like Spotify. We don't like all those streaming platforms, especially Spotify. It just takes the magic out of the whole musical experience. I feel sorry for young folks coming up these days that they consume music just on Spotify. That's a big bummer. Like, part of it was having something physical, opening the inlay card, reading the words. Reading the thank you for person. You know what I mean? And then getting your metal magazine or whatever and going, oh, reading about it more. And, you know, it's just that's unfortunately gone. So we're going to try and preserve that a little bit with this release.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. What metal magazine did you get? Did you buy Metal Hammer?
Metal Hammer, Kerrang, because I was in Ireland, so I had all the English ones.
Yeah. Terrorizer?
What?
Did you get Terrorizer? Did you get that over in Ireland? Terrorizer?
It's after my time, I think.
All right, that's sort of a step up beyond into sort of more death metal.
Yeah, no, I didn't. Riser.
Yeah, gone. No, but Metal Hammer was the classic. Yeah, that was like the. I remember when I was in a metal band, that was like the pinnacle. If you can get a Metal Hammer with your album and get it reviewed by Dom, I think it was Dom. His name, anyway. It was like the pinnacle of being an unsigned metal act. For the audience listening then, so Honeybeard's next album, Oneiros, is going to be released November the 16th. Did I get that right? November the 16th?
Yeah.
On vinyl, and it's going to be available on Bandcamp. So do go check that out. It is going to be in the show notes. And if you are trying to think when this episode is going to come out, I think it's going to come out. Yeah, it's going to come out after the gig on the 15th of October. But do you have any other dates of any other sort of gigs or anything else that might be happening in the near future?
Nothing booked right now. It's still kind of up in the air here in Ontario of how long everything is going to be open. So we're hoping that everything stays open till at least the 15th here.
We've been thinking about live streams, but we did two live streams early last year, and they were loads of fun. But we didn't think the production of our production was where we would have preferred it. If we do release something, it'll be on a larger, more professional scale, like something that I didn't see Ollie Ride's one, but I heard about it. So it'll be something like that, a proper production, not like a in a bedroom kind of thing. That's not how we present ourselves, you know?
Yeah. So,
I don't know. I don't like live streaming either. I don't know. It just doesn't feel the same. But you just gotta do what you work with, you know? Last year we were supposed to go to play a show in London, UK, and we were supposed to play a show in Rhode Island, New Retrofest. And we had other plans to play around the world, but that all fell apart. So we're going to see how it goes. Maybe next year we'll find ourselves in London playing a show. There's a couple of whispers of things that might happen. So we'll see. But we definitely, we have to play live, put it that way. We have to play live.
Yeah. That'd be ace if you could make it over to the UK. I mean, I'm in the Southwest at the moment. So, but unlike Canada, I can get to the other side of England within about three hours. Then I'm on the East Coast. So it's setting a gig up over here is quite easy. So yeah, it'd be ace to see you guys over here. I'll definitely make my way over to that. That'd be amazing. So yeah, Gaz and Tom, huge thank you for spending the time with me today to chat through your music and the up and coming release. It's been great. And maybe later on in the future, further releases, we'll get you back on and chat a bit more about music. That'd be amazing. And hopefully the other side of the pandemic, when the live scene's opened up, and maybe discuss a bit more on how that's going as well. That'd be brilliant.
Thanks, Mark.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us on.
Not a problem. Anytime. And I'll help push the release as well as much as I can. And as I said earlier, we'll get all the details in the episode show notes for the audience too. So yeah, big thanks, guys. And I'll speak to you soon.
Thank you very much.
Speak to you soon. Thanks.
Cheers. And there we have it. That is the end of this episode. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, please do leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Podchaser. Social media links and podcast links are available in the episode description. If you would like to know more about me as a producer and mix engineer, please do visit www.markmatthewsproducer.com, or as a mastering engineer, visit www.synthmusicmastering.com, or you can reach out via Instagram at Inside the Mix Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and look out for the next episode that will drop in 2 weeks, Tuesday at 6 a.m. Thanks for listening. Whoa! Before you go, make sure to snag your free test master from Synth Music Mastering. Imagine enhancing your music with my steadfast dedication to quality and that personalized touch. And here's the kicker, it's absolutely free. No cost at all. Simply head over to synthmusicmastering.com or click the link in the episode description to claim your free test master.